Chapter 23. Then did P and I once more embark in our four-oar galley, and glide swiftly down the river with the tide. And while the shrewd east rasped and nudged us, as with jagged razors, did my friend P impart to me confidences of interest relating to the Thames police. We, between whiles, finding duty boats hanging in dark corners under banks, like weeds our own was a supervision boat and they, as they reported all right. ... flashing their hidden light on us, and we flashing ours on them. These duty boats had one sitter in each. An inspector. And were owed Rand an ... which for the information of those who never graduated, as I was once proud to do, under a fireman waterman and winner of Keene's Prize Wherry, who, in the course of his tuition, took hundreds of gallons of rum and egg at my expense, at the various houses of note above and below bridge, not by any means, because he liked it, but to cure a weakness in his liver, for which the faculty had particularly recommended it may be explained as rowed by three men, two pulling an oar each, and one a pair of sculls. Thus, floating down our black highway, sullenly frowned upon by the knitted brows of Blackfriars, Southwark, and London, each in his lowering turn, I was shown by my friend P that there are, in the Thames police force, whose district extends from Battersea to Barking Creek, 98 men, 8 duty boats, and 2 supervision boats, and that these go about so silently, and lie in wait in such dark places, and so seem to be nowhere, and so may be anywhere, that they have gradually become a police of prevention, keeping the river almost clear of any great crimes, even while the increased vigilance on shore has made it much harder than of yore to live by thieving in the streets. And as to the various kinds of water thieves, said my friend P, there were the tier rangers, who silently dropped alongside the tiers of shipping in the pool, by night, and who, going to the companion head, listened for two snores, snore number one, the skipper's, snore number two, the mate's mates and skippers always snoring great guns, and being dead sure to be hard at it, if they had turned in and were asleep. Hearing the double fire, down went the rangers into the skipper's cabins, groped for the skipper's inexpressibles, which it was the custom of those gentlemen to shake off, watch, money, braces, boots, and all together, on the floor, and therewith made off as silently as might be. Then there were the lumpers, or laborers employed to unload vessels. They wore loose canvas jackets with a broad hem in the bottom, turned inside, so as to form a large circular pocket in which they could conceal, like clowns in pantomimes, packages of surprising sizes. A great deal of property was stolen in this manner, P confided to me, from steamers. First, because steamers carry a larger number of small packages than other ships. Next, because of the extreme rapidity with which they are obliged to be unladen for their return voyages. The lumpers dispose of their booty easily to marine store dealers, and the only remedy to be suggested is that marine store shops should be licensed, and thus brought under the eye of the police as rigidly as public houses. Lumpers also smuggle goods ashore for the crews of vessels. The smuggling of tobacco is so considerable that it is well worth the while of the sellers of smuggled tobacco to use hydraulic presses to squeeze a single pound into a package small enough to be contained in an ordinary pocket. Next, said my friend P, there were the truckers, less thieves than smugglers, whose business it was to land more considerable parcels of goods than the lumpers could manage. They sometimes sold articles of grocery and so forth to the crews, in order to cloak their real calling, and get aboard without suspicion. Many of them had boats of their own, and made money. Besides these, there were the dredgermen, who, under pretense of dredging up coals, and such like from the bottom of the river, hung about barges and other undecked craft, and when they saw an opportunity, threw any property they could lay their hands on overboard, in order slyly to dredge it up when the vessel was gone. Sometimes, they dexterously used their dredges to whip away anything that might lie within reach. Some of them were mighty neat at this, and the accomplishment was called dry dredging. Then, there was a vast deal of property, such as copper nails, sheathing, hardwood, and sea habitually brought away by shipwrights and other workmen from their employers' yards, and disposed of to marine store dealers, many of whom escaped detection through hard swearing, and their extraordinary artful ways of accounting for the possession of stolen property. Likewise, there were special pleading practitioners, for whom barges drifted away of their own selves, they having no hand in it, except first cutting them loose, and afterwards plundering them innocents, meaning no harm, who had the misfortune to observe those foundlings wandering about the Thames. We were now going in and out, with little noise and great nicety, among the tiers of shipping, whose many hulls, lying close together, rose out of the water like black streets. Here and there, a Scotch, an Irish, or a foreign steamer, getting up her steam as the tide made, looked, with her great chimney and high sides, like a quiet factory among the common buildings. Now, the streets opened into clearer spaces, now contracted into alleys, but the tiers were so like houses, in the dark, that I could almost have believed myself in the narrower byways of Venice. Everything was wonderfully still, for it wanted full 3 hours of flood, and nothing seemed awake but a dog here and there. So we took no tier rangers captive, nor any lumpers, nor truckers, nor dredgermen, nor other evil disposed person or persons, but went ashore at Wapping, where the old Thames police office is now a station house, and where the old court, with its cabin windows looking on the river, is a quaint charge room, with nothing worse in it usually than a stuffed cat in a glass case, and a portrait, pleasant to behold, of a rare old Thames police officer, Mr. Superintendent Evans, now succeeded by his son. We looked over the charge books, admirably kept, and found the prevention so good, that there were not 500 entries, including drunken and disorderly, in a whole year. Then, we looked into the storeroom, where there was an oakum smell, and a nautical seasoning of dreadnought clothing, rope yarn, boat hooks, sculls, and oars, spare stretchers, rudders, pistols, cutlasses, and the like. Then, into the cell, aired high up in the wooden wall through an opening like a kitchen plate rack, wherein there was a drunken man, not at all warm, and very wishful to know if it were morning yet. Then, into a better sort of watch and ward room, where there was a squadron of stone bottles drawn up, ready to be filled with hot water, and applied to any unfortunate creature who might be brought in apparently drowned. Finally, we shook hands with our worthy friend P, and ran all the way to Tower Hill, under strong police suspicion occasionally, before we got warm. A walk in the workhouse. On a certain Sunday, I formed one of the congregation assembled in the chapel of a large metropolitan workhouse. With the exception of the clergyman and clerk, and a very few officials, there were none but paupers present. The children sat in the galleries, the women in the body of the chapel, and in one of the side aisles, the men in the remaining aisle. The service was decorously performed, though the sermon might have been much better adapted to the comprehension and to the circumstances of the hearers. The usual supplications were offered, with more than the usual significancy in such a place, for the fatherless children and widows, for all sick persons and young children, for all that were desolate and oppressed, for the comforting and helping of the weak-hearted, for the raising up of them that had fallen, for all that were in danger, necessity, and tribulation. The prayers of the congregation were desired for several persons in the various wards dangerously ill, apostrophe and others who were recovering returned their thanks to heaven. Among this congregation were some evil-looking young women, and beetle-browed young men, but not many perhaps that kind of characters kept away. Generally, the faces, those of the children excepted, were depressed and subdued, and wanted color. Aged people were there, in every variety. Mumbling, blear-eyed, spectacled, stupid, deaf, lame, vacantly winking in the gleams of sun that now and then crept in through the open doors, from the paved yard, shading their listening ears, or blinking eyes, with their withered hands, poring over their books, leering at nothing, going to sleep, crouching and drooping in corners. There were weird old women, all skeleton within, all bonnet and cloak without, continually wiping their eyes with dirty dusters of pocket handkerchiefs. And there were ugly old crones, both male and female, with a ghastly kind of contentment upon them which was not at all comforting to see. Upon the whole, it was the dragon, pauperism, in a very weak and impotent condition, toothless, fangless, drawing his breath heavily enough, and hardly worth chaining up. When the service was over, I walked with the humane and conscientious gentleman whose duty it was to take that walk, that Sunday morning, through the little world of poverty enclosed within the workhouse walls. It was inhabited by a population of some 1,500 or 2,000 paupers, ranging from the infant newly born or not yet come into the pauper world, to the old man dying on his bed. In a room opening from a squalid yard, where a number of listless women were lounging to and fro, trying to get warm in the ineffectual sunshine of the tardy May morning in the itch ward, apostrophe not to compromise the truth a woman such as Hogarth has often drawn, was hurriedly getting on her gown before a moldy fire. She was the nurse, or wardswoman, of that insalubrious department, herself a pauper, flabby, raw-boned, untidy, unpromising, and coarse of aspect as need be. But, on being spoken to about the patients whom she had in charge, she turned round, with her shabby gown half on, half off, and fell a-crying with all her might. Not for show, not querulously, not in any mawkish sentiment, but in the deep grief and affliction of her heart, turning away her disheveled head, sobbing most bitterly, wringing her hands, and letting fall abundance of great tears, that choked her utterance. What was the matter with the nurse of the itch ward? Oh, the dropped child was dead. Oh, the child that was found in the street, and she had brought up ever since, had died an hour ago, and see where the little creature lay, beneath this cloth. The dear, the pretty dear. The dropped child seemed too small, and poor a thing for death, to be in earnest with, but death had taken it, and already its diminutive form was neatly washed, composed, and stretched as if in sleep upon a box. I thought I heard a voice from heaven saying, "It shall be well for thee, O nurse of the itch ward, when some less gentle pauper does those offices to thy cold form, that such as the dropped child are the angels who behold my father's face." In another room, were several ugly old women crouching, witch-like, round a hearth, and chattering and nodding, after the manner of the monkeys. All well here? And enough to eat? Apostrophe a general chattering and chuckling, at last an answer from a volunteer. Oh yes, gentlemen. Bless you, gentlemen. Lord bless the parish of Saint So-and-so. It feed the hungry, sir, and give drink to the thirsty, and it warm them which is cold, so it do, and good luck to the parish of Saint So-and-so, and thank ye, gentlemen. Apostrophe apostrophe elsewhere, a party of pauper nurses were at dinner. How do you get on? Apostrophe oh pretty well, sir. We works hard, and we lives hard like the sodgers. Apostrophe apostrophe in another room, a kind of purgatory or place of transition, six or eight noisy mad women were gathered together, under the superintendence of one sane attendant. Among them was a girl of 22 or 23, very prettily dressed, of most respectable appearance and good manners, who had been brought in from the house, where she had lived as domestic servant, having, I suppose, no friends, on account of being subject to epileptic fits, and requiring to be removed under the influence of a very bad one. She was by no means of the same stuff, or the same breeding, or the same experience, or in the same state of mind, as those by whom she was surrounded, and she pathetically complained that the daily association and the nightly noise made her worse, and was driving her mad, which was perfectly evident. The case was noted for inquiry and redress, but she said she had already been there for some weeks. If this girl had stolen her mistress's watch, I do not hesitate to say she would have been infinitely better off. We have come to this absurd, this dangerous, this monstrous pass, that the dishonest felon is, in respect of cleanliness, order, diet, and accommodation, better provided for, and taken care of, than the honest pauper. And this conveys no special imputation on the workhouse of the parish of St. So-and-so, where, on the contrary, I saw many things to commend. It was very agreeable, recollecting that most infamous and atrocious enormity committed at Tooting, an enormity which, 100 years hence, will still be vividly remembered in the byways of English life, and which has done more to engender a gloomy discontent and suspicion among many thousands of the people than all the Chartist leaders could have done in all their lives. To find the pauper children in this workhouse looking robust and well, and apparently the objects of very great care. In the infant school, a large, light, airy room at the top of the building, the little creatures, being at dinner, and eating their potatoes heartily, were not cowed by the presence of strange visitors, but stretched out their small hands to be shaken, with a very pleasant confidence. And it was comfortable to see two mangy pauper rocking horses rampant in a corner. In the girls' school, where the dinner was also in progress, everything bore a cheerful and healthy aspect. The meal was over, in the boys' school, by the time of our arrival there, and the room was not yet quite rearranged. But the boys were roaming unrestrained about a large and airy yard, as any other schoolboys might have done. Some of them had been drawing large ships upon the schoolroom wall, and if they had a mast with shrouds, and stay set up for practice as they have in the Middlesex House of Correction, it would be so much the better. At present, if a boy should feel a strong impulse upon him to learn the art of going aloft, he could only gratify it, I presume, as the men and women paupers gratify their aspirations after better board and lodging, by smashing as many workhouse windows as possible, and being promoted to prison. In one place, the Newgate of the workhouse, a company of boys and youths were locked up in a yard alone, their day room being a kind of kennel, where the casual poor used formerly to be littered down at night. Divers of them had been there some long time. Are they never going away? ? Was the natural inquiry. Most of them are crippled, in some form or other, said the wardsman, and not fit for anything. They slunk about, like dispirited wolves or hyenas, and made a pounce at their food, when it was served out, much as those animals do. The big-headed idiot shuffling his feet along the pavement, in the sunlight outside, was a more agreeable object every way. Groves of babies in arms, groves of mothers and other sick women in bed, groves of lunatics, jungles of men in stone-paved downstairs day rooms, waiting for their dinners, longer and longer groves of old people, in upstairs infirmary wards, wearing out life. God knows how this was the scenery through which the walk lay, for 2 hours. In some of these latter chambers, there were pictures stuck against the wall, and a neat display of crockery and pewter on a kind of sideboard. Now and then it was a treat, to see a plant or two. In almost every ward there was a cat. In all of these long walks of aged and infirm, some old people were bedridden, and had been for a long time. Some were sitting on their beds half naked, some dying in their beds, some out of bed, and sitting at a table near the fire. A sullen or lethargic indifference to what was asked, a blunted sensibility to everything but warmth and food, a moody absence of complaint as being of no use, a dogged silence and resentful desire to be left alone again, I thought were generally apparent. On our walking into the midst of one of these dreary perspectives of old men, nearly the following little dialogue took place, the nurse not being immediately at hand. All well here? No answer. An old man in a Scotch cap sitting among others on the form at the table, eating out of a tin porringer, pushes back his cap a little to look at us, claps it down on his forehead again. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.